Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. We're going to wish you all a happy St. Patrick's Day, although I don't believe that our program has anything to do with St. Patty's Day, does it?
There's nothing specific in here. No, there isn't.
But we're always green.
Yeah,
that's our philosophy.
Are we green?
We're green.
Well, we're not orange anywhere. Or at least if we're orange, we don't admit it. We have actually driven through that part of Ireland, and the only thing that's very peculiar about it is that in the Irish Republic, which is usually where we start out, all the distances on the roads are in kilometres per hour. When you cross into Northern Ireland, you go into miles per hour, and it seems like the distance got very much shorter until you cross back into error again, and then all of a sudden you have more kilograms and more kilometers than you thought to get to the airport or wherever else you're going.
Kilometers.
But that's beside the point, I guess.
Anyhow, but we have some nice finds on today's program.
Oh, we have some very interesting people.
I was really thrilled to find it, -8 vinegars. I mean, I never knew that they existed. I don't know why I didn't, except they sell mainly to chefs, I guess.
And Brad, who won't even use his last name.
Right.
He apologizes for his own inability to understand what's going on, and yet he makes the most beautiful vinegars out of ice wine. So you're going to want to find out about this product and see if you can't track some down to cook for yourself, or at least find a restaurant which is using them. So here we go with -8 all the way from St. Catharines, Ontario, Canada.
You know, I have a question. I just tasted these -8 wine vinegars, and I don't understand. They are so good. How in the world, Brad and Rachel, did you stay away from my radar, or not on my radar for so long?
Oh, we worked really hard at it. It was tough, and I don't know. No, it's really limited production. It's hard to make. A lot of this stuff is not fun to make. You're working in the middle of the night. We're not really trying to grow it that much. We sell to restaurants. We're not really looking for that saturation. We sell to a couple of restaurants in a lot of different cities, and that's pretty much been good enough for us so far.
Well, now you started out, you were raised on a farm, you were always around growing things and also, I guess, around winemaking. From your father, was that?
My father never made any wine at all. No, I started that end of it, but I did have the luck of growing up in a wine growing family. Now, when you're growing grapes, especially back in when my grandparents started it in the 50s, you grew juice grapes and then they just make wine out of juice grapes. But my grandfather and father grew the wine grapes of the 50s and 60s, which was like Deschonac and 9549 and Elvira and varieties that are all gone. But the Labrusca winery grapes. So we never grew Niagaras and Concords and stuff. We never went to the juice.
But you started actually making wine. Now, let's mention where you're making this, where you're from.
I'm from St. Catharines, Ontario, in Canada.
And it's cold.
It's a cold climate grape area, and it's a lot warmer there than you'd think because we're surrounded by the lakes, and you get that hot water bottle effect because we're right sandwiched in between Lake Erie and Lake Ontario. So we're usually about 5 to 6 degrees warmer than say Toronto or Buffalo even on either side of the lake because of that. This year's has been a little extra rough because we've had those long stretches of cold and the lakes have started freezing. So that's why we're getting more cold weather. Usually it's really tough for us to get -8. And that's why we usually talk
about -8. That's
-8's that kind of golden magic number where the grapes are just hard enough. They're frozen to pick. And then when you pick them, and usually that only happens in the middle of the night, and you pick them and you press them immediately.
Right then,
in the middle of the night. It's all done in the middle of the night.
So ice wine was what you were making.
Now this is ice wine vinegar.
And the -8 is the temperature at which you pick them.
That's the minimum temperature that you can actually pick the grapes and they're not mushy or sloppy or anything. Okay. It's the temperature where it's actually worked. Typically we go at -10 just because you just have that much of a buffer. But even if it's -10 or -12 and the sun's up, the sun sort of melts the outside of it, and it really kind of it screws up the machinery and everything and the presses, and it's just
were
not.
Were you involved, Rachel, when it was a wine producing company?
What Brad does is grows grapes. So most of the farm is designated for grape production, which goes to wineries. And this vinegar making and wine making is a hobby. And it started out as a hobby. And when we met, we were in the same wine tasting course, and we would go around to, in our group, each other's house once a week and do our wine tastings there. So when we went to Brad's house, we used to get to go to the barn. I mean, after a few bottles of wine, he would say, okay, let's all go over to the barn and we'll see what he has in the tanks. And we'd taste wine that he was making, whatever it happened to be, out of barrels or out of tanks. And then one day he said, well, I made some vinegar over there. Do you want to try some vinegar? And we're like, yeah. What is it? Well, I made it out of ice wine. So anyways, we all try this vinegar, which is now -8. And we all went, what are you doing with this stuff in the corner of a barn?
Right.
Someone should be using this. And so I took it to some chefs up in Montreal, because for me, Montreal is where amazing food is in Canada at the time. That was it. I was driving it to Montreal to take it to the chefs there, and the chefs bought it there. So I said, why don't we sell it and give it a name and start a business? And we did. And then we started going to New York and to cities one at a time. And
you're even in Europe, I understand.
Yeah, then we went over to Europe, and now we have, well, there are chefs all over the world that use it now. We'll look it up on the internet. Just type in -8 Bricks, and it comes up on menus all over the place with chefs we've never even spoken to. It's just grown, and distributors have taken it, and it's all over now. So it started out in the corner of a barn, and it's ended up now Brad makes a whole line of different vinegars, and yeah, it's been
and
a lot of fun.
How did you hit on this?
I think I just hit on it through other chefs using it and seeing it, and so I was curious to what it was and just purchased it through a distributor, and then realized how good it was and started moving on to using more of them, and I think they're just really excellently made and work really nice to do a variety of things with without being harsh on the palate.
Right. I mean, I think they're delicious. You then decided what? You were bored. Why did you jump to this vinegar?
I think, Well, the story is that I read, and I remember just having some balsamic vinegar, and it was like, it wasn't cheap. It was like 25 or 30 bucks.
No, I bought it in Moden at $125 for this much.
And I remember tasting it going, this isn't very good. And it was kind of like on a dare. I said, I can make something better than that. And not better than all balsamic, just that specific bottle I'm referring to. And so that's how it started. I just did it.
Well, how many different vinegars do you have?
Well, these would be our four main ones. I also do a verjus, and there's a new vinegar coming out at the end of the year, which would be our first.
So what do we have here? We have late harvest. Everything has an 8 in it for you.
We kind of have that theme running through it.
Late harvest, dehydrate.
Yes.
Which I loved.
Oh, thank you. A lot of people
that.
Like that one.
And I was fascinated when I was reading that you were working with Concord grapes.
Yeah, which everybody's been ripping out, and there's no market for it. And
no market for it?
No, there's hardly any Concords. Well, in Canada. The juice plant shut down, which Welch's, a couple years ago. So they've ripped out all the Concord grapes, and they're not actually it's a neighbor's farm that was abandoned. And rather than just let it go to nothing, I just took it. And I said, well, I can try and make something good out of it. And so then this was born, kind of out of necessity. It had no home, so
adventurous guy, Brad.
It's not scary. I grew up growing. When you're growing stuff, then it's easy. It's everything else that's scary, you know?
Well, this one is Concord.
It's Concord 8, yeah.
Concord 8. And then what about...
The last one's -8. That's
-8
the flagship.
The name of your...
Yes, that's the name of the company too. That is, we used to just have -8.
Now tell me about, you have a process for picking, which frequently ends up in the middle of the night, right?
Yes.
And what about this aging?
Aging, well, some of them are aged, like the Concord's not, that's why it's so much brighter and fresh. And the late harvest is aged in bottle, but not in oak. The other two that we tried were, they're aged in French oak. And I've tried American oak, but it's just a little too aggressive. Just because, basically, oak robs fruit. And I like my vinegars to be a little more fruit forward.
Or actually, that, I and should I like mention
it, but the oak does give it a roundness and it does make it a little more approachable because it has that slight oxidation because it's a permeable vessel when it's an oak. So it definitely makes it more drinkable. And this one will age about 5 to 7 years.
You make it sound so easy, but you never made vinegar before. And I want to just echo back before you answer the question. I want to echo back. We were talking with someone in South Africa who was a winemaker. But one year, his entire crop was bad, and he made a whole crop of vinegar.
See, I totally disagree with that. I think that it's only as good as what you start with, and you can't have grapes that are already starting out with high VA and make this kind of vinegar. Because what happens is when you start with acetic acid present before you go into alcoholic, you get that amyl acetate, that nail polish remover, which you'd find in a lot of cheaper vinegars. You have to start with really high end, like these get treated like our premier wine, and that's how it goes in. It has to go in pristine wine to come out like this kind of vinegar. You can't just make dumped stuff, and I think that's the common misconception.
Well, do you use the French vinegar making system?
Yes, the New Orleans method.
New Orleans.
Yeah.
No, I should just clarify that this was a winery, but this particular year's crop was a failure.
Yes. Yes. And, no, I know what you mean.
And that's how come they discovered vinegar, and although they make wine, their vinegars are what they're now celebrated for.
What did they do? And it wasn't easy, and there was. And I have dumped a lot, and actually we have it removed because you can't just dump it because it's hazardous waste, actually.
Really?
And yeah. Well, I tried spraying it before you can use it as a herbicide, but it was just so cost prohibitive to try and filter it and make it do stuff. It's just not realistic. So we just had it removed. But there's been lots that doesn't work out.
Now, so you're doing this big dinner at Casbah in Pittsburgh.
Yes.
With Chef Eli Wall tomorrow. And, Chef, talk to us a little bit about this concept. I mean, you're going to be integrating these vinegars into the dishes, and that had to have been a lot of work and a lot of creativity to do. And you're also going to let people sample the vinegars. And then you also, that is totally daunting, you also have selected wines to pair with. Could you tell us a little bit about what this menu is going to produce? What do you have on it? And how did you integrate all this?
All right. So I think first off, all the vinegars have their own distinct flavor and therefore pair with print things very well. And not to say that somebody else couldn't take one of the vinegars I used in a certain course and put it in another one is not an untrue statement. I think other chefs could take those and put them in other courses. But for the Muse Bouche, we're going to do a snapper ceviche using the late harvest vinegar and red apricot verjus. And I think those two flavors are very clean and will pair nicely with the raw fish with a little bit of chili and pomegranate and fresh chervil. And I think those vinegars and the apricots will lighten the fish and cure it and make a very delicious bite.
So you use this vinegar instead of lime to marinate the fish for ceviche?
Yes, we're going to do that. There will be a touch of lime in it, but the lime is not there. The lime is less than normal, and we're using the vinegars more to cure the fish and will be the highlight of the dish.
And it's paired with a Meyer lemon ice wine.
Yes, yeah, so we made...
Wouldn't that be...
is a Meyer lemon
puckery?
Shrub.
Pickery?
It has a lot of sugar to it, so it's going to be a sweet Meyer lemon. Then we're going to pair it with one of Brad's ice wines and mix that for the cocktail to go with that.
And then we move on. The first course is bread and butter, which, I mean, the bread with this would be absolutely...
So we're going to do a little bit of, it's going to be a little piece of crisp focaccia, and the butter part comes from Vermont Butter and Cream Company, a cheese called Kupel.
You couldn't get better than that. That's fabulous.
A cheese called Kupel, and I think I chose the grape 8 for this. I call it grape 8. As a little humor of my own. It's actually Concord 8. So we're going to use Concord 8 to pair with this. And I chose that because, as Brad mentioned before, it's probably the brightest, freshest vinegar of them. And I think that bright freshness will help cut the creaminess and fattiness of the cheese very well. And so that's where I chose that vinegar. And it's also going to have toasted oats, a little bit of greens, and sumac, which is also bright in flavor as well.
It grabs you.
Just indeed. Go ahead.
So that is where the Concord 8, or as I call it, Grape 8. And that is, I think, going to be a very good course. And the wines, I think, complement very well. I don't have all the information on the wines, as our wine director helped pair with this.
You said you actually doused some of these wines with vinegar to see how it went.
Yes, we did. This particular course we did not, but I know a couple of the other courses. For the foie gras course with the wine, we added a little bit of the -8 vinegar into the wine. And also for one of the later courses, we added some of the wine and vinegar together and to see how they would taste and see what it was like. And it was actually very interesting. It was maybe one of the most exciting parts for me of putting this dinner together was I know what the food is, but my wine knowledge is not vast. So taking different wines and putting the vinegars in to see how they went together was very exciting. And there was actually several wines that I liked better with the vinegar. And so that was pretty interesting, I think.
I love this chestnut ravioli, of course, and it's great.
So, yes, that course I think is going to be very nice. A little bit earthy chestnut mixed with a little bit of ricotta and mascarpone. And I actually put a little of the sweet 16 vinegar into the ravioli filling. So we start with a nice earthy Miner's lettuce. And then a little bit of poached pear, which we poached in the white 8 bricks verjus and beach mushrooms. It'll have a little bit of earthiness. So you're going to have a little earthy sweetness, a little bitterness from the greens. And I think that course is going to go together very nicely.
Okay. And then we do charred prime strip steak.
Yeah. So for this charred prime strip steak, this is actually going to feature Brad's newest creation, which is not yet released to the public, called IP8. And we're making pickles with the IP8 vinegar, whole grain mustard, grilled romaine, cured egg yolk, and then veal jus with IP8 vinegar in it. And I think that course you're going to get a little bit of the pickle tartness, the mustard, romaine, the rich beef, and then a little bit of cured egg yolk to add a little saltiness and more richness to it. And I think the jus will help round it out with a little bit of that IP8 in it.
And the finale?
Finale, we have a milk sponge with a dehydrate shrub, strawberry shrub, candy Americana almonds, and black pepper meringue, which is kind of going to be a play.
Oh, that's going to be fun.
That's going to be a play on a strawberry shortcake. And for the shrub, you take whatever fruit you're using, you mix it with vinegar, and then mash it with a bunch of sugar, then let it sit till it all dissolves. And then you strain that out. So you have sweetness from the sugar, but you also have sweetness from the dehydrate, which is maybe one of the sweeter vinegars from the raisins being dried before they're pressed to make the vinegar, and happens to be my favorite of the vinegars as well. So.
Well, that's great. It sounds like an absolutely fabulous menu. Rachel, you do the marketing, don't you? And do you love interacting with all the chefs? They're characters, aren't
that
they?
That was so much fun when we used to travel and do that. I just loved it.
You don't do it anymore?
No, we had kids, and they're little. So it's been years since we've really traveled. And so it's great to come to Pittsburgh and to meet Eli and to talk to some chefs and to be able to eat some amazing food again is very nice. And I do miss that interaction and going to see the kitchens and meet the chefs, because they usually have very vivid imagination. They're very creative people, and just the ideas that they come up with for what to do with the vinegar. You give them a little taste on a spoon, and then they say, I'm going to make this, 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 and this.
Oh,
and
do they?
It's so much fun. Yeah, because everybody's different, and they're very quick thinking as a group of people, and it's just nice to talk to them. And yeah, one day we'll be able to go out and do more of it again, but I'm really happy to be here now doing this. It's a treat.
Brad, you really talk a lot of technique here. You probably learned a lot in this vinegar making routine, huh?
It was a lot of trial and error. One of the winemakers I worked for taught me a lot. He was a winemaker, but he was also a microbiologist, and I bounced stuff off him. And he never made any vinegar or anything before, but he just knew the educational background, exactly how it works and stuff. And I'd say, well, I was going to try this. He goes, oh, that might work. Or else he'd go, yeah, you're totally barking up the wrong tree. But most of it's just trial and error. You just got to keep trying and trying different things and new things. And when you get one that works, then you stick with it.
Well, we're now at that ultimate issue. If you only sell to chefs, how do people find the chefs that are using your vinegar so they can taste the product?
Well, a lot of chefs, and we're lucky, a lot of them put it right on their menu, like Eli does. He, and this is even outside of just this vinegar dinner, Eli lists our products as they are in his menus, which we really appreciate. And there's,
and everybody does that?
Not everybody. There's a lot that don't, and there's some that buy it and don't admit to using it, and there's some that showcase it. So it's kind of whatever. It's up to each individual what they want to do.
Tell us your website, because it's interesting to read.
If someone wanted to go to a restaurant that was using Minus 8, they could just email in through the contact on the website, and I would answer and say, this chef, or this restaurant, etc. You could go there and try it. But you can buy the products on the website if you'd like to use
home. Okay,
yes, you can.
So that is good. And
so
the website,
if someone wants
is?
One bottle, it's www.minus8vinegar.com.
And the 8 is the numeral 8.
Numeral 8, MINUS, numeral 8, VINEGAR. Yep.
Well, that's good. So we do have a happy ending, because they're just about sold out with a dinner anyhow here, and if you're not in Pittsburgh, that's not going to help you, but you can go on the website and order some of these, and I would highly recommend this Concordate and the Dehydrate. I love both of those. I mean, I like the others too, but those particularly were my favorites.
Thank you.
Well, thank you both for letting us sample and telling us the story, and thank you, Eli, for
bringing it all together.
Thank you very much.
The architect.
It's going to be a fun night.
You're going to have fun.
And we'll be back with an all-American story from the West Coast to the United States right after the break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. I guess that we could actually classify this program as things we really should have known about that we didn't, because this next cheese, River's Edge Chev, is so fantastic. I don't know how we didn't know about it.
Well, yeah, but these are very small operations. I mean, the Minus 8's a very small operation. River's Edge Chev is not exactly in the mainstream of things. I think we're delighted that we found them.
Well,
after
they certainly
all.
Are in the mainstream. They're winning all the cheese awards around. So we did find them, and we'll never lose them again. Let's listen to Patricia and Estrella Morford. I'm looking at this magazine article that I thought was just absolutely charming, and it has a headline that says, "To discover River's Edge Chev will feed your cheese-loving soul," and believe me, it certainly fed ours. Welcome to On the Menu, Patricia and Estrella Morford of River's Edge Chev. Hello.
Thank you for having us.
Oh, yeah. I just couldn't understand why I didn't know your cheese, because you're in Oregon, which we love, and we try to follow Oregon products a lot. And you sent us samples of the cheese, and we've been munching on that, and it's extraordinary. You did explain to me, because your email is three ring, as in three ring farm.
Correct.
What is the structure of this? And you are, I should point out, a mother-daughter team.
Yes.
And the structure is the farm that's a family farm?
Yes. We have a small farm here in the central Oregon Coast Range. We have 12 acres, and we raise dairy goats and dairy sheep. We have Alpine dairy goats, and we have East Parisian and Lacan sheep.
Right. Do you make sheep cheese, too?
Well, we're working towards that. We're working towards making a mixed milk cheese.
Oh, wow. That's great.
We're still in the working phase, though, because we have to get those sheep up on the milk stand.
Yeah, but now, Patricia, you grew up there, didn't you, on this farm?
Well, I grew up in Oregon and Washington, basically, and have spent my time in both of the areas.
You didn't start out to make cheese, did you?
No, I've had dairy goats pretty much most of my life. I got introduced to them when I was about 8 years old. We lived on Vashon Island, and my dad brought three little baby goats home. And I spent my time playing on the beach with the goats and the dogs and my brothers, and basically just developed a real lifelong love of the animal. They're just wonderful animals. And as a young adult back in 1969, I got goats again to, you know, raise my family with, and have had them pretty much ever since, except when we lived on our fishing boat.
I guess that would be hard.
So
yeah.
So initially,
although there are goats that have been seaborne many times through history.
Really?
Yeah. They've usually had goats that went on the boats, you know, on the ships with the sailing guys that were doing all the exploring and everything. They usually all had a goat.
Wow. Now, why was that?
Well, it was to provide milk and food for the people, you know, basically the captain, you know, the higher-ups. They would always have a goat for their hot cocoa and milk in their coffee.
Wow.
Oh, my goodness. I never knew that. Now, let's put a little dot on the map, because you say the Central Oregon coast, but if looked at from the point of view of someone from a distance away, you're sort of almost in California.
Okay. No, we're right basically just about in the middle of the Oregon coast.
Okay, got it.
And about 8 miles inland from the ocean.
Okay, but the weather pattern you're dealing with is sort of like Northern California where Mary Kay from Cypress Grove is. No, it's different?
No, it's much different.
Okay.
We get a lot more rain, and since we're in the mountains, we also get snow in the winter.
Hey, really?
Yes, uh-huh. So we have, it's kind of an interesting climate area here because we have the maritime influence, which means that we get cool in the evening in the summertime, but we get as hot as the valley weather, like the Willamette Valley, during the day. But then it'll cool down at night because we're not very far from the ocean. And in the wintertime, we get a lot of huge storms that come through. You know, it's not uncommon for us to have 70-mile-an-hour winds and sometimes gusts up over 100, which makes the roof rattle. But we have a lot of rain in the wintertime, but then we also have some nice weather as well.
But it must be that much more difficult to actually farm goats, right?
Well, surprisingly enough, our goats do really, really well. You know, we have really good conditions for them. We've got nice big barns with lots of straw bedding and everything. But in the summertime, the feed is just incredibly lush. They'll go out there starting in the spring when everything is growing, and you can't even see them because everything is so tall and overgrown. And then through the summer, you know, they work their way down so that basically you can see their ears, and then pretty soon you can see their heads. And then, voila, you've got animals out there.
Now, my cousin who lives in Tasmania does some farming, mostly of avocados and tamarillos and passion fruit, things like that. But he used to have two goats that he kept over the fence near the pond, and they used to take all those scraps and just throw them over the fence.
Ha! Composters.
Well, sort of, because the grass doesn't grow quite as tall as it does in Oregon. But I remember talking to him once, and he said, I found out a lot about goats. He said once I asked somebody how long a goat would live, and he said, as long as their teeth hold out.
Yes, they do. And we've had some live as long as 18 years.
Oh, wow. There you go.
Yeah, and productive up until they were 14. But then you have some that might pass away when they're 8. It just depends. Yeah.
Now, how did Astrea get involved with the goats and the cheese?
Well, I went to Oregon State University to study horticulture. And right when I graduated was when the business got up and running and licensed. And so I came back to help for a while and kind of figure out what I really wanted to do, because what I had wanted to do wasn't really in the picture of doing more market gardening stuff for the horticulture. But so I came back and I stuck around and I haven't left, and it doesn't look like I'm going to leave.
Oh, that's great. And now, what was you started out making cheese like casually, didn't you?
Right. You had lots of milk. Oh, gosh, this would have been started around 1970. I had a lot of milk because I bought goats that did milk really well. I got a couple of old girls that were from up on Mount Hood somewhere that were being used as brush goats, but they turned out to be incredible bucket busters as far as milk production went.
I never heard that term. They were what? They were
bucket busters, where they really filled the bucket full of, milk.
I mean, you said brush goats?
Brush goats, right. Yeah, they were just being used to clear brush, you know, blackberries.
Oh, geez, they eat blackberries.
I met this woman out on a dirt road somewhere and bought them for $20 each.
Oh, wow.
So anyway, I had a lot of milk. I got them the year before, and then when they kidded, they freshened with a lot of milk. I mean, one of them was giving 2 gallons a day, and this is no exaggeration, and the other one always gave 1.5 gallons. And we couldn't drink that much, even with the children that I had, so I started playing around with the milk and made basically squeaky cheese, you know, cheese that you make with buttermilk and just let it set, and then also made ricotta. And I made yogurt, and I made kefir, met some people that had kefir grains, and made, you know, gallons of kefir and then would mix it with raspberries and honey. And it was really wonderful stuff, you know. But it wasn't the cheese that we make today. I mean, it's just, there's no comparison at all.
So what changed your direction?
Well, we were involved in commercial fishing for many years. And about 1988, I got more serious about trying to produce animals that were really, really beautiful and had really good milk production, because I thought people would be interested in buying the animals for milk. And the reality of it was is that pretty much in the United States, we're still not in that realm of being able to really consider dairy goats. You know, we're getting there, but it's not the same as what it is with, like, dairy cattle, where you can make a living selling really supreme animals. We exported most of our animals to other countries where they value dairy goats immensely. So at that point, fishing was really kind of circling the drain, and I thought, okay, well, we better do something serious with these animals. We've got a lot of milk. We've got beautiful animals. You know, we've got longevity of lactation. And started collecting up equipment, thinking that, you know, we could get a loan because we own the property. And lo and behold, an old house on a farm doesn't really give you money, so I ended up having to take a long time to get the dairy going and ended up with a farm service loan at the very end to finish it. And so I started collecting it in 1993, and it was 2005 before we got licensed. It took that long.
Wow.
Now, how do you actually learn how to make goat cheese?
Well, there's a lot of information out there, and especially now, I mean, there's a huge amount of information.
On the internet,
yeah. To begin with, well, and then classes and stuff, I mean, it's all the rage now. But back then, you basically had to learn through trial and error and, you know, just finding whatever snippets of information you could get. I didn't have the freedom to travel to France or any other country and study under anyone because I didn't have the finances, and I had to be here to take care of things. But through the years, you know, trial and error, the cheese got better, and then I did, you know, at that point there were classes that were beginning to pop up. I went to Washington State University and took a short course up there. I took a couple of classes with Peter Dixon, who is a wonderful teacher. And then Oregon State over here, we have the dairy pilot program going over here now, and there were some classes over there that I took as well. And it all worked. And the other thing that's really, really important is that we just have extremely wonderful milk. The milk is perfect.
You've gone beyond just learning how to make goat cheese to making some of the goat cheese that's the most recognized and most valued in the world. Tell us a little bit about some of the triumphs that you've managed to bring to your wonderful goat farm.
Well, let's see. Where should I start? Astria, maybe you should take that one because I can't even hardly remember all of them. Well, we've done really well in the competitions, which has been really quite rewarding, because when you're making cheese, you're working every day, especially if you have the animals too, and it gets a little, sometimes it gets feeling like it's a lot of work, but it's really nice when you can make a product and not only have it sell really well, but you can send it off to these competitions all over the world and then get awards for it.
And realize
that it can go up against cheeses from Europe that have been being made for hundreds of years, and it can hold its own.
And so this
last year in 2013, we won 2 best American cheeses, and that was extremely rewarding. And in the past at the American Dairy Goat Association, we have gotten, in 2011 and 2012, we got Best of Show with two different cheeses.
That's really
so
good.
We've done really well, and it's really quite rewarding.
Well, one of the exciting things was with the first competition outside of the United States we did was with the Guild of Fine Foods show. That was in the Canary Islands, and we got two silvers and a bronze. And that was exciting because you are competing with other countries from all over the world that have a really long history of cheesemaking. And then, let's see, last year, of course, we got the Super Gold, and then it went Best American Cheese. But we've had a number of Super Golds through the competition there in Britain, the Guild of Fine Foods, which is really, really great because we don't have the history of cheesemaking here in the United States.
No, not at all.
That they do in other countries. And it's really pretty. It rings the chimes. You know, it really is great to do that.
It does. Now, tell us about some of the different products. We've sampled three out of the several that you sent us so far, and I can't really remember all the names. Some of them are rather curious names anyway, but why don't you run through the product line?
Humbug.
Well, let's see. I think the ones that I sent you was, of course, the Up and Smoke, it's a hand-formed round of cheese that we smoke with alder, and then we wrap it in big leaf maple leaves that we collect, and we smoke the leaves to dry them after they've been washed, and then we mix them with bourbon. And that has been a really good cheese.
No wonder it tastes good.
Yeah, it is. It's really a tasty little cheese, and it's great to cook with, too.
Cook, yeah.
It's wonderful stuffed in chicken breast, pork, fish. It's wonderful in fish. It's absolutely supreme. But it also makes a great onion tart as well. So that was one of the cheeses I sent you. Then Humbug Mountain, truncated ash-coated pyramid.
Right.
Now that's named for a mountain off of the southern Oregon coast. When we were trolling, you know, fishing down there, we could see it was kind of a landmark, you know, one of those things that you could see when you were trolling. And it's basically shaped just like the Humbug Mountain, and it's a black from the ocean side. It is the stone. It's got a stone face that's black. So it really went with the name, you know, it was perfect for the name of the cheese.
Oh, wow.
And then the little round that I sent you that had the fern on it is Silk Coos.
Okay, we have that.
And that's named for a small lake that's between Newport and Coos Bay. That's just a beautiful little lake.
Now, then you had one
the Sunset Bay.
That's it, where you might expect to find ash running down the center, but you put something altogether different in there.
Yeah, it's Spanish smoked pimenton.
Uh-huh.
And we use Delalia paprika, and it's a smoked paprika. Yeah, that's a lovely cheese, and that was a Super Gold. Let's see, was it last year?
Last year.
Yeah, well, 2012. It was a Super Gold at the Guild of Fine Foods.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your distribution is concentrated pretty much on the West Coast. But do you do also online ordering?
Yes, we do. We don't have a shopping cart, but people can look at the website and then they can call us and order what they'd like. But we do have a certain amount of sales on the East Coast and then in the Chicago area.
Okay. And what about this website? What is it?
It's Three Ring Farm or Rivers Edge Chev. If you put in either one of those, you'll come up with it.
Great. I had one last thing I wanted to ask you before you go. It always concerns me about cheese because I see refrigeration as the enemy of cheese.
Yeah, have refrigerate on it.
But everything you sent us says refrigerate after I'm refrigerated at all times.
Keep refrigerated. So.
And, I mean, is that essential? I mean, if you have a cool basement at the temperature of like 50 degrees, would it be all right to store
it
there?
It depends on what kind of a cheese you have.
Okay.
With a soft ripened cheese, pretty much you want to keep it cold until you're ready to eat it, and then you bring it out and let it come to room temperature.
Okay.
Most of the cheese that you're going to be purchasing is going to be ready to eat. Now, if you have a chunk of hard cheese, you could keep it in a cool place. That would be fine.
But goat cheese, you think refrigeration is wise?
Well, with a soft ripened or a fresh Chev, you'd want to keep it refrigerated, yes.
Okay.
But if it's an aged cheese, a harder, you know, the harder it is, you can just keep it in a cool condition.
Okay,
we do have different ideas of how cheese should, any food should be stored here in the United States. In Europe, they have a cupboard that's cool that they keep most of their food.
You know, yeah, that's exactly
And then you would just have your milk and
soup or you know, milk and meat in the refrigerator.
And no, they don't even refrigerate eggs.
Well, no, growing
right.
up.
Right. But, you know, if you don't wash an egg, there's no reason to refrigerate it.
Really?
Yeah, it's the washing process. When you wash the egg, you're taking off the protective coating on it. You can leave, you know, eggs at room temperature for several weeks without any problem.
Wow, I didn't know
if
that.
They're not washed.
Well,
but that means you have to have really clean eggs, too.
Yeah, we also don't know whether they've been washed or not.
Right, unless you know where they've come from.
But
well, it was a real delight to find you, and I understand that further down the road here, we're going to probably encounter your sheep's milk cheese, or a mixed goat and sheep milk cheese, huh?
Yes.
So how far along is that process?
Well, I'm hoping that we have some of those this year.
Really?
Oh,
yes.
Great. Well, you must make sure we get some and then come on the show again and talk to us about what we were supposed to expect as opposed to what we actually taste.
Well, that would be terrific. We'd love that.
We'd love to be part of your tasting panel.
All right. Well, I'm sure that Astrid and I would both be glad to have that happen.
Great. Well,
and if you ever make it over to Oregon, come visit us.
Well, we go to Portland a lot.
Yeah, we've been in Oregon. We've been as close to you as Newport.
Well, we're not far from Newport. We're only 20 miles from Newport.
Yeah. So we have to make a visit. There are some wineries in the southern Willamette Valley that we need to go see anyway. So,
you know, there's even some wineries over here towards the coast now, too.
Right, right. Willamette Valley Vineyards is the one that we're most familiar with. We've had them on the program.
Oh yeah, huh?
And I don't know whether I don't know how close they are to you.
That's about 60 miles away.
Oh, that's not too bad. Okay, well ladies,
Patricia,
have a wonderful day,
Astrid,
and thank you so much.
Yes. Well, thank you for having us.
Again, it's River's Edge Chev, and believe me, you are going to be delighted, and we are too. So thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And don't go away, because we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
And here we are again, and with yet another find, Max Wattman. Well, I knew his previous book. We had a copy of Chasing the White Dog, which is Moonshine, but somehow I never got around to interviewing him. Now with his new book, he breathes new life, wit, and wisdom into a very popular and, you know, you'd think it might even be overdone, but it's not the way he presents it, subject called Harvest, Field Notes from Far-Flung Pursuit of Real Food, and we had a wonderful time. If you like rye wit, you're going to love Max Wattman's latest book called Harvest. Welcome to On the Menu, Max.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Set the stage for us. You start premise of slime in your hamburger.
I do. Well, I mean, there's a moment, I think, in my life when I decided that I didn't want to eat garbage. I didn't want to just accept people's idea of what food was or how bad food could be, and that happened to me at a restaurant eating a hamburger. It should have been a perfectly harmless situation. It disgusted me, and I thought, you know, maybe I should really pay attention to what's going on, ask some questions, and try to get better at it all.
Well, now, a lot of people have done this back to the earth kind of thing that you're writing about in this memoir. Well, you call them field notes from a far-flung pursuit of real food, which gives a certain slant on it. But Barbara Kingsolver wrote that book about going back to the farm and raising everything. There were some other, well, actually, Michael Pollan did some of that.
Sure.
So how is this book different from all of those?
Well, a lot of what I was trying to do was to make it tenable, to make it possible for people to do. I mean, it's a wonderful project to sell your apartment in the city and go out to the country and raise everything yourself, but what if you like the school your kid goes to? Or what if you like your job? Or what if you just don't feel like moving out to the country? I think there should be a kind of, you know, a modular approach that you could take on whatever it is that you feel like you can take on. And I worry that people are discouraged to try things because so many of the examples have gone so far in their attempts. And I also felt like there was something kind of artificial about, if I was to have set it up and said I would only do something for a year, or I was going to make a bunch of new rules for myself, then it would have felt like a like artifice. It would have felt like
that's
something
what Barbara did, actually.
It is, right?
Yeah.
And she certainly did a good job at it, and I don't mean to you know, cast any aspersions her way, but I just, for me, it didn't seem like that was a natural way to proceed.
I like her fiction better.
Yeah.
And I'm a little bit confused.
Yeah. What?
We're talking about Max, about his new book called Harvest, uh-huh. Field Notes from a Far Flung
Pursuit of Real Food.
Of real food, but in fact, the pursuit of real food in the way of coming into this book happened only fairly recently. But you seem to have somehow described a lifetime of experiences that relate to something thoroughly healthy about food. Where does the visit to Cognac with a stopover in Paris and eating raw epoisse, where does that fit into the project? Had it already happened and you just clued it in to this particular book?
That, I think I was already working on this book when that happened.
Oh, you were? Okay.
That's exactly what I mean, that there's no arbitrary line for me. There's no calendar demarcation that I say, you know, well, in January of 2012, I decided I was going to eat well, and then in December of 2012, I'm going to be done. You know,
uh-huh.
I've cooked and thought about food and worked in food most of my life, and I've traveled to eat, and I've enjoyed it, and I just...
And you cook?
Yes.
Yes, you do.
Yes, very much.
Starting with that early chicken. I was a little startled by the automobile accident that your family was in. I was reading about bubbles, and then I heard about this accident.
What did happen? Did you run over a chicken?
Well, it's all the story of my whole life, really. It's just told in a certain way. And sometimes, you know, if I find that the best way to describe to someone what it's, you know, what some traumatic experience feels like is the time I wrecked my car, or if the first time I cooked a meal was for my parents after a car accident. And uh-huh. I think those things are important milestones, and they're much more important milestones to me than got an assignment to try something out or something like that. You know,
I can still picture you running, rushing around the country of France with increasingly smelly cheese.
It really did start to smell.
No doubt.
There was no ignoring the suitcase after a couple of days.
So you didn't get to bring it the rest of it home.
Oh, I ate it all. It was clean. It was a challenge, but I ate it all.
My mother used to do that. She'd become her whole suitcase would reek of cheese.
Yeah.
Now, your wife, Rachel, must be a saint.
She's very tolerant of my experiments, but they're fun experiments. You know? She gets many happy byproducts. She gets to eat a lot of the stuff, too. And she's a pretty enthusiastic eater herself, and she's certainly game this, all of these adventures.
Yeah. Now, you have something I read, and you talk about the ups and downs, and you certainly have your share of catastrophes in this book, and your I don't want to call it experimentation. I mean, what should I call it? And your journey? I'm so tired of the word journey, but...
I know what you mean. Yeah. I mean, experimentation is worth it. Experimentation works.
But, like, your poor chickens. I just thought it was such a poignant episode.
Oh, those poor things. Well, that was when I realized that I really might have something to write about. I was trying to work through the loss of the chickens.
Uh-huh.
And I ended up writing about that just because that's what I do. It's one of my natural, you know, how am I going to think about this? I'm going to write it down. And that's when I really started to see that I had something I could write about.
Now, listeners are going to have the other part of the story before they're going to be encouraged to buy your book and listen to the rest of your interview. So for those who didn't get to that part of the book, tell me about the chickens. Tell me what happened to the chickens.
Well, I had some lovely birds happily pecking around in my yard and picked off one by one by a raccoon.
Oh, okay, then I did see that part of the story. Yeah. Okay. That's like my cousin Richard's wife, Lo, who had a long duel with a bandicoot. Which is a piece of Australian wildlife which knew about all the bulbs that cost $5 a piece and only ate those.
None of those cheap 75 cent
bulbs.
None
of the cheap ones. No, always like the really tasty ones, the ones that have just been planted.
Well, what are they to do? Those are, you know, we put them right there. We served it up like a buffet, is the way I came to think about it.
Is that right? A raccoon buffet.
Yeah.
Oh, dear. Tell us about some of your other really affecting.
How about wacky?
No, I mean, things that you really related very strongly to about your disasters, because you seem to have had a number of them.
Well, I really count them as disasters. I count them as, they're still entertaining to me, and they still mean a lot to me. I think that there's a lot of satisfaction in failing to do something. In fact, I think if every time you try, you get it all right, it's not a very... For one thing, it's not a very realistic way to present what happens to people, because it's never true. I mean, you know, our life is not a series of perfectly executed ideas. And the only thing that breaks my heart is not trying. Better to try and mess it all up and be left with cheese that isn't that tasty. Better to try that than to just assume that I can't do it and not try at all. At every turn, I think I was enthralled by the process, and I felt like I was learning things. Some of them were very confusing, though. I mean, I've cured meat haphazardly, really, for years, and always with success. And when I tried to dial in and get it really right, because I was going to write about it and I didn't want to tell people to do things irresponsibly, suddenly it didn't work. When I just kind of packed Eye of Round in salt and then hung it under the eaves of my porch, it was delicious. But when I measured and calculated and timed and weighed and thought about things in terms of grams and tried to control the humidity, suddenly it was all spoiled. So that's, I don't know if it's disappointing. It's certainly confusing.
I would guess so. I loved your friends' comments that you envisioned. You imagined what their comments were about all of your various adventures.
Well, I think I'm always amusing them with feeding them raw meat and cured meat and... things that don't often show up at your average dinner party, but they must enjoy it. They keep coming back.
All right, well then you're doing your job here.
Now Bubbles holds quite a place in the saga.
First, tell us, how much was Bubbles when you bought him?
$600 and some odd.
No, I meant how much did he weigh?
Oh, how much did he weigh? Oh, you know what? I got that backwards anyway. He weighed 175 pounds,
and he grew to
about 1,100.
Okay, your first thought was you were going to keep him in your yard.
Well, I'd say I thought that for maybe an hour, maybe a day. I didn't know where to put him, really. I mean, I knew I wanted to buy a steer, and I knew I wanted to try to raise a steer from a yearling up through finishing weight. But I didn't really have an immediate idea where to do that, because I don't live on a farm. I live in a town. The point in talking about putting him in my yard was really to illustrate that most cattle live in smaller areas than that. And in fact, according to the standards by which we raise these animals, my yard is
really big.
Big enough.
Yeah,
really
big. The one thing I wanted to remember to mention is that the way, I mean, I've read the same kind of information over and over and over again from different sources, but the way you put these things really makes a mark.
Thank you.
Yeah, and so even though you know about this feedlot business, the way you phrase it all and present it, as I said, it strikes home, and it's a whole new image.
So where did Bubbles live then? I mean, everybody's now anxiously aware of the fact that we don't have the whole story. Did Bubbles go away to fat camp?
They all go away to fat camp, I think. Bubbles stayed on the farm where he was bred, a great farm called Wolf Creek Farm in Madison, Virginia, just outside of Madison, where a man named John Whiteside raises great cattle. And it's going to take him to a friend of mine's farm down there, and it just, for various reasons, kind of never really worked out. The transfer never worked out. The farms are right across the street from each other, in fact, so it hardly matters. It's just a fence line worth of difference, really.
Yeah.
But it worked out pretty well for me for Bubbles to stay on Wolf Creek Farm until he was old enough.
And one of your chapters is Bubbles Gets the Gun or something like that. I thought that was really kind of...
Well, I think that...
It is. Bubbles Gets the Gun.
It is, yeah. One of the things
wasn't
that was
that a little stark? I mean, weren't we already fond of Bubbles?
Well, that was part of what was important to me, was to deal with this stuff matter-of-factly and viscerally and to not try to hide it in metaphor, not try to remove myself from it anymore. I mean, I was there when he was shot. That was it, you know. Relieved that I didn't shoot him myself, I thought for a little while that there might be a situation in which I would be called upon to do that. And luckily for me, there's licensing issues and things like that. You know, it's an actual business, and you can't just let anybody who walks up to your abattoir shoot the animal.
It's which like a journalist friend of mine got inspired by Michael Pollan to slit chickens' throats.
Exactly. I mean, well, because how can you not if it's available to you?
Yeah.
Is the question, you know? You don't want to write down, so I didn't do it because, ew. You know, that doesn't go very far.
Well, Virginia didn't do it for very long, I can assure you.
I think once, that was it.
Yeah.
So anyhow, so go ahead, continue in your line of thought with the,
I didn't want to mask it, you know, I mean, the whole reason to get closer to your food and the whole reason to run these series of experiments was to know as much as I could about it. And so I guess sometimes that's going to be a little bloody and sometimes that's going to be by my hand or nearby, and I didn't want to write it as if that wasn't happening.
Well, you went hunting, too, and am I wrong in my assuming that you are not a naturally talented hunter?
Well, I think it's pretty clear through most of the book that I'm barely a naturally talented anything, but I'm willing, but not necessarily talented. No, I'm not. I don't have a long history of hunting. I grew up very much in the country, and so I have spent a fair amount of time walking around in the woods with guns, as I say, but not with real intent, for the most part. And this was the trip that I write about in this book was the first real hunting trip I'd ever taken. I went out to North Dakota to shoot some pheasants. And it was great. It was really a wonderful experience. The country is incredible. The land is big out there in a way that East Coasters can't even imagine. Amazing birds, and it's an amazing bird hunting is really, really something.
Did you get any?
I got quite a few. I think I took 6 that hunt.
There you go. Now you also talk about fishing, which is a slightly less active way of passing the time.
That's true. I love to fish, and I have fished most of my life. I think we all get busy and stop fishing at some point for a while, as much of it as I can, never as much as I'd like to.
Now, it seems to me that it's mostly about cans of beer and cigars.
It certainly can be about cans of beer and cigars, and most of the best things in life are about cans of beers and cigars.
Good. Oh, I'm glad you're on my side there. I was worried for a minute there. I thought you were such a reformed character, you wouldn't even talk to us anymore.
Oh, please.
But then your last book was called Chasing the White Dog, so...
Well, that hence the reform, right? That was the one that sent me straight to the...
That's what it was? Okay.
Tell us a little bit about your last chapter about a cow is not always black and white.
Well, I was having a hard time ending the book for the most part, because of what we were talking about earlier, that it's not an arbitrary delineation. There's no date to stop it, and it's not as if I'm going to stop cooking. I've been cooking since I was 12, so I'm not going to, okay, I'm done, you know, and I'm not going to go back factory farmed forever, a lot of these changes. Mm-hmm. And that makes it very hard to tie a bow on the end of a book and say, you know, here we are at the end. And I was cooking dinner for my son one night, or for my family and with my son. He was doing his homework in the kitchen, and he has to come up with sentences. He was in second grade at the time. He has to come up with these little sentences for vocabulary words that he's working on, and his word was always. And he said excitedly that he had it, and I said, "What's your sentence?" He said, "A cow is not always black and white," and I just thought it was
brilliant.
Perfect, because that was my problem. I'd been looking for black and white solutions to these things instead of realizing that, you know, no, it's not going to be black and white. It's not going to be cut and dry. I'm not going to be able to just say, you know, with one last thrust of the overture that we're done, I'm going to have to kind of fade out.
That's
good. So that's how you faded out.
That's how I faded out.
Oh boy!
Not with a banger, but with a whimper.
Exactly.
Well, Max Wattman, you're welcome to have dinner with us anytime.
Thank you. That's a wonderful invite.
Yeah, especially if you bring parts of Bubbles.
I will.
Oh dear. Well, keep us on your mailing list for your next book. Although I'm not sure I would tackle homeschooling at all.
It's daunting.
Yes.
For me as well. Yeah. I kind of can't believe I thought of it at all.
Anyhow, good luck with harvest.
Thank you.
And, and keep enjoying your back-to-earth activities.
I will. I do.
Yes. And talk to us again soon.
I hope so. Thank
you so
much. And
don't forget the dinner invitation.
Okay. I will not forget the dinner invitation. Believe you me.
Thanks, Max.
Thank you.
Ciao. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, there you have it for the day before St. Patrick's Day. Once again, if you're wearing the green, enjoy wearing it tomorrow. We'll see you the same time, same place next week, whether you're Irish or not.
Bye-bye.